Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Our guest today is Martin Geis, and we speak with him about his new book, Fast Forward, Accelerating B2B Sales for Startups, which he co-authored with Matthias Hilpert.
The problem is that emotionally, a founder is desperate for someone listening to him and desperate for someone signing, giving him some revenue. But the problem is if whoever is that doesn't fit your strategy and who your end customer is, you're wasting time. So you need to be very disciplined to developing a hypothesis who your customer could be and focus all your talks on exactly these customers. Because the second part, this magic scaling, only works if you have a common denominator, that you have one product that fits a lot of similar customers. And to make your sales easy, those should be reachable by the same sales processes, and they should reference each other. That gives a lot of extra momentum.
Martin is an active angel investor with 13 investments in startups like Connexon, Orbem, Engflow, Wapier, Cliniserve, and Spira. He is co-author of two books and blogs on startup financing and B2B sales for startups. He mentors founders in leading global programs such as Expreneurs, Alchemist, ESABIC, Wiconomy, and EIT Health, and teaches courses in negotiation, leadership, sales, and business model incubation in leading universities such as the Executive MBA of TU, Munich. Martin builds on his many years of professional experience as a leader in the telecommunications industry. He was involved for 15 years in the successful PE cycle around Cable Deutschland, helping to revitalize the nationwide cable infrastructure, leading to a successful IPO and subsequent acquisition by Vodafone. Now, on to this insightful episode with Martin Geis. Martin, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted to have you here, and I'm so glad that you could make time all the way from Stanford to so early in the morning to hop on this call.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Thank you. You have written this very important book about startups and sales, and you call it Fast Forward. B2B sales from startup to unicorn. Why did you think of writing this book?
I believe that it addresses a need in the startup world. Actually, it's my second book, and my first book in German is about finding investors for your startup. And one of the big lessons of that book was if your sales look good, all this stuff with investors gets much easier. But getting your sales done, I believe it's a craft, but it's not really taught and not much written about. So if I look into academia, I see a lot writing on marketing, so addressing consumers, individuals, but not on the business side. And I've been reflecting why that might be, and I believe marketing is much easier to analyze because you have relevant sample sizes. You have replication, you have a lot of the same. B2B sales to business consumers may be individual, And they may not have the best reputation. Many non-salespeople think of these people with a lot of attitude, with a lot of tricks, a little bit of sleaze in that, maybe even a little bit of bribery. So it's also not where an academic wants to put his reputation, but it's where I get a lot of questions. So I spent my usual year coaching maybe 50 to 70 startups on their journey, on their go-to-market phase, and converting that first customers, doing that repeatedly, identifying the pattern and standardizing it is what makes them successful. So I get the same questions all the time, so I figured I'd put them in a book so I don't have to answer them each time.
that's as good a reason as you can have. But tell me, from your experience, why do startups actually push the moment of truth, which is actually asking somebody to pay for their product, as far as possible? Why is that?
I think many founders can be quite uncomfortable with the sales topic. As I said, it's rarely what they studied and specialized or what was so far the hallmark of their career. So they may be scientists, engineers, computer programmers, even business people define themselves then more about strategy or business development, about conceptually perceiving who should buy it, but the actually doing isn't taught. So you see two error modes. One is not doing it and delaying it, which often also goes with an element of perfectionism. So you just say, I'm not yet ready to face those customers, so you don't do it. And the other extreme is you just want to delegate it. So it's wishful thinking that you could just take this perfect salesperson, maybe even from a large corporate, which would be worse, and transplant him and doing the sales for you. But that has a lot of negative side effects. A, these people don't exist, at least not with a startup spirit and passion like yours. And you just lose so much signal quality in the process. So if that guy talks to customers, tries to translate it back to you, you lose valuable information. And he will also not understand your product as well. So the customers lose information when he tries to explain it instead of you. And that guy also can't fix the product and initiate a product change, a pivot, if that is what the customers tell you to be necessary.
That's a great answer. Before I move on, I also want to ask you, not learning sales is not about only startups. Basically, sales is not taught at all. I mean, of course, there are books and courses and, you know, separate exercises, if I may say, extracurricular kind of thing. But till recently, I don't think universities offered any structured course where one could go and get oneself educated about sales.
It's starting, actually. I have been cooperating with MIT and Bill Aulet, who is one of my role models, and they initiated a course on B2B sales. So more people are seeing this topic as relevant. But you also asked, is this book relevant, Billy, beyond startups? We believe yes, but when we wrote it, we purposefully focused on startup because we felt it's the clearest case of sales without noise if you sell a product for the first time instead of in an established organization. And we didn't want to make the book thicker by thinking a lot about how does this apply to a mid-sized company, to a large size company. So these people are invited to read the book. They may need to do some transfer to their situation, but I'm sure they learn a lot as well from this book.
So you're taking your own lesson of the second mistake you talk about, starting with a market segment that's too large, right?
Yeah, actually, I had many people thinking about this book project more from the commercial side, saying, Martin, you're crazy. The world has a lack of entrepreneurs, and you focus your book, in principle, only in entrepreneurs that do B2B startups and that are ideally pre-revenue, so they can follow you through the entire journey. So that is a relatively small target group. But at the same time, it gave clarity to our thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's great because I think it sort of works in tandem with what you are talking about. So let's step back a little and tell me about the process, because this was, I mean, one side there is humongous amount of material available, lot of work, as you have quoted yourself, lot of work has been done sort of in adjacent areas in the lean movement, Steve Blank and his four steps to epiphany. A lot of these are about this space, not necessarily B2B, but developing sales and which should be led by the founder, etc. So how did you think of structuring the book and how was that process?
So maybe let me first stress that a book always is a team process, and you have the people who prominently stay on top of the book, and that's Matthias Hilpert and myself. Hmm. So Matthias is a fellow business angel. He lives in Berlin, has a great track record in telecommunications that evolved a lot of sales, and is also working with his startups very intensely on this topic. And he happened to give a brilliant presentation and workshop on sales in an incubator I ran. Hmm. So we discovered a joint interest. And already having written a book, I smelled that there's something in this. And the third person who owns a lot of credit for this book is our editor, Rieke Brandt, with whom I'd worked already on my first book. Hmm. So she's the one who also worked with us two busy guys to collect our pieces and was very deeply involved in the whole structuring of the book and in making it very readable. And our structuring device was following the journey of a first-time founder through the different steps that he needs to address. And we kind of put the sales journey in four steps, kind of getting from zero revenue to maybe $100,000 annual recurring revenue that we called Explore. Hmm. Then from 100,000 to a million, Learn, followed by a standardized phase up to 10 million and an optimized phase up to 100 million. So you first discover how it works and then you repeat. And when you have repeated, you identify the pattern and you build an organization around doing that. And we put different topics in this logical order. So it starts with market segmentation.
Right.
So kind of testing and clarifying whom you're selling to. And at the very other end of the journey, we have a large chapter on customer success. So once you have a signature, on the one hand, you have to make sure that that customer is happy and gets what he paid for. That's kind of an element of operations and customer service. But every customer also is a great opportunity to sell more, either through referrals, through prolongations, through additional products, through deeper penetration, through inbuilt transaction-based pricing, through price increases, and that's an opportunity you shouldn't waste either. But that comes in the later stages.
Sure. Let's talk about market segmentation. This is a perennial problem for founders, right? So what you talk of, in fact, you talk about the 10 mistakes, it's sort of linked to that. This whole idea that everybody is my customer too, actually narrowing it down to the one which is the lowest hanging fruit or will be the most ready to sort of adopt and so on and so forth. How do you actually suggest that is done? I to my mind, that's the most complex thing to do.
I mean, part of it takes a trial and error mindset and a lot of experimentation. So kind of you need to go out there during the week, and at the end of the week, you need to sort through what you learned and optimize. But the important one is that you really structure it like a science experiment, and that you also exclude a lot of stuff. So the problem is that emotionally, a founder is desperate for someone listening to him and desperate for someone signing, giving him some revenue.
Mm.
But the problem is if whoever is that doesn't fit your strategy and who your end customer is, you're wasting time. So you need to be very disciplined to developing a hypothesis who your customer could be and focus all your talks on exactly these customers. Because the second part, this magic scaling, only works if you have a common denominator, that you have one product that fits a lot of similar customers. And to make your sales easy, those should be reachable by the same sales processes. And they should be should reference each other. That gives a lot of extra momentum. And a key point is a lot of people, when they feel they are close but not yet there for this magic product market fit, which is a big milestone for a startup, they look towards changing the product. And that typically is a big effort and takes a lot of time. And sometimes it might be easier to take your product and find a customer where it is already perfect.
Right.
And one of the case studies I always use is PayPal. They actually almost failed because they thought to bring their peer-to-peer money service to the richest people they could think of. So high net worth individuals using Palm Pilots, which was a cool gadget of the day. But those people had no use case wiring money to other filthy rich people, so there was no momentum whatsoever. And then someone, I believe deep in the organization, discovered eBay power sellers, who may be more hustlers, not as wealthy, but they had the use case. They were sending money back and forth with other private citizens 100 times a week. And even better, they onboarded those business partners into PayPal, and it took off. So being flexible in identifying where your opportunity is and then making clear decision whether this is it, whether this one A works and B is large enough, is a big step. And then ideally you find some hacks how you find your segment even better. I mean, if you find them, they sometimes sound so trivial, but we have a almost unicorn LeanIX from Germany. They sell enterprise architecture software. And at some point, someone said, why don't we identify all enterprise architects on LinkedIn and contact them? Of course, if to sell a 20,000 euro a year software, if they gave someone the job title to care about this topic and pay him 80,000 a year, that sounds very accurate. And they immediately also had a point of contact who was knowledgeable and could evaluate the offering. So that little hack improved their sales by factor three. And this is what no textbook sells you, and it's something you can only find yourself, but that's kind of the truffle hunt that I want to send the founders on personally during this phase.
One thing, I'll actually skip down to your chapter five, where you talk about pain and connecting to the customer by pain. So when you want to find people who already have the problem and not trying to pivot the product and so on, how do you go about doing that?
I mean, there are various elements to that. I mean, one part of it is conversation skills. So asking the right type of questions. It's always important to tell what not to do. So many people get someone on the phone and like a waterfall, they talk about all their brilliant features and how it's saving the world. And they explain the other person their business. So that's the wrong mindset. So a good sales call may be two-thirds or more of listening to understand the other person's business, showing them you care, listening what their problems are, and then connecting the dot that this luckily is what you are already fixing at other customers and working them through the logic what you do. But it's kind of their world to which you connect, and you graciously accept the invitation to enter that world, and you make yourself useful. So good questions and especially listening are two skills that are very important. And right. a big point, as I'm a numbers guy, you also need to quantify your value.
Hmm.
Of course, that's then a very important documentation of what you do. And you kind of need to rank it on the priority list of the other person. So if you are the number five priority of that person, you probably still move on to the next customer, even if you could help. Of course, we are so busy, our inboxes are full, and people don't get to work on their number five priority. At least right. you can't make them work on it.
Right. So you have to find customers for whom your solution, their pain, solving their pain is priority number one, to which you can potentially provide the solution. That's yes. the one to go after, right? Obviously.
Yes. And I'm very clear in the book, it needs to be a perceived pain.
Mm.
And they also need to be able to accept or perceive the quality of your solution. Mm. I believe companies have a lot of problems that they ignore so deeply that it will be very hard to connect. So for me as a negotiation coach, I have a fervent belief that companies are very poor negotiators because they send out these lonely wolves into battle. They don't give them clear instructions. They don't have good debriefing. Mm. They don't have a common process.
Mm.
Totally different from like accounting or project management. So I believe there is place for helping them to do this better. But when I used my own medicine and talked to companies about this, the first problem was nobody wanted to talk with me. So it was somebody else's problem. And if you have a true problem, but the customer refuses to accept it, you will likely have a very hard time to doing something about
true,
it. So a variant of this is, so one secret of the book is we talked to about 40 top-level founders, many of them unicorn level, about their own sales journey. And one of them, Gregor Stühler from ScoutBee, a procurement startup, he said, we had this elaborate calculation how much our process saved versus a perfect procurement process. But that didn't help us. And one customer brought it to the point. He kind of took him aside and said, you know, we never do this process. Let me explain what we really do, which was mostly buying from the same people that they buy anytime. But so his, he couldn't, they wouldn't see a saving against the process they should do, but didn't do. So
right.
it's,
exactly.
I mean, in the end, you have, you connect to the customer's world and you have to accept their version of what the saving is. And you can't analytically prove a customer wrong. That may be intellectually satisfying, but it's not useful in terms of your sales process.
Absolutely. Before we move on, I mean, one of the connected topic that you deal with is finding the right decision maker. So we all talk about the buying committee, you know, a lot of Gartner reports and Forrester reports around that in B2B especially, it is never one person who is deciding to buy. How do you actually go about, because I know that there are softwares today, there are people who are trying to build, you know, organization charts so that when you look at a company, you can figure out and so on and so forth. But if you're trying to sell one particular thing, I mean, you may be selling ERP software, or you may be selling a productivity software, or you may be selling raw material for all for the sake of the argument. Obviously, the whole structure of who is going to decide will be different, right?
Yeah. No, it's... So you need the mindset of an explorer drawing the map of a new place and kind of putting in first the landmarks and then the details.
Right.
And you kind of need to figure that out for your specific sales process.
Okay.
And there is multiple frameworks around who the key players are that you should look for.
Mm-hmm.
So the one we are promoting in the book was used from Bill Aulet from MIT.
Mm-hmm.
So, and key roles you look for, there is the end user. So you definitely need to understand who will be the one using your product. But often that person is deeper in the organization and not really personally involved in your sales process.
Right.
Then second person is the economic buyer. So someone owns a budget against which you will be evaluated, and will sign your order. So identifying that person and what he cares about or she cares about is very important. Then there is a concept of the champion, that maybe someone within the organization, either overlapping with those other roles or independent, who kind of really wants you to succeed, helps you, gives you a little bit extra information. That's very important. Then typically there are influencers, so people just have can sway opinion. That can be inside the organization or even outside. Can be important contractors, media, and others. And then there's a dangerous category that's called the veto powers. And that's something you should think very strategically. So you may never meet them if you don't look for them because they are not in the room. But that may be the head of IT with a not invented here attitude who's always stopping the topic when it gets into interesting discussions with the customers. And you need to learn about these people. You may need a strategy to get past each of them. But the good thing is you can just ask your counterparts. So if you have someone who's excited about the product, it's like, who else do we need to involve to get this done? What do they care about? Oh, you need to get past your finance organization. Can I put together some charts? We have something that worked at another customer very well. So they make it, use the first ones who are on your side to kind of build support and to kind of tackle it as joint problem solving to motivate and get past the rest of the players.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break,
you create a list of people who you believe should use your product, but that haven't yet heard of you. That's prospects. Then you need to contact them, at least get some initial validation that who they are and get some contact data. Then you have a lead. If you get enough positive feedback to prioritize them, you have a qualified lead. Then you typically work through a sequence of field visits, demos, initiating negotiations, so you have an opportunity. And at the end of the process, you hopefully have a customer.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. Let's move to the sales process. How early do you look at the process? I mean, at what stage? At explore or learn? Or where is it that you start sort of solidifying your process? Should you at the beginning, for instance, at all think of a process? Is it purely sort of Wild West kind of free-flowing? You keep experimenting and keep documenting. Is that the way to go?
So in terms of the book, we have it pretty much in the middle. So right. The first part is kind of rapid experimentation. And as it is just the founder doing it, he doesn't need much organization. But of course, you try to collect those learnings from this phase to then draft your process.
Right, right.
And I mean, on a very high level, each of those sales processes look very much the same. So you create a list of people who you believe should use your product, but that haven't yet heard of you. That's prospects. Then you need to contact them, at least get some initial validation that who they are and get some contact data. Then you have a lead. If you get enough positive feedback to prioritize them, you have a qualified lead. Then you typically work through a sequence of field visits, demos, initiating negotiations, so you have an opportunity, and at the end of the process, you hopefully have a customer. So at this level, this looks very much the same, but of course, the details depend on the industry structure. If you have an oligopol and only five customers on this planet for your product, you have a totally different sales process than when you have millions of customers. And we use a concept from a Berlin VC partner, Christoph Jantz, who actually designed five types of animals to describe customers of a different size, thinking from how much money do you make in 1 year. And at the low end of the range, you have the mice, so who only contract with you for like $100 a year. In that case, you are very close to all those B2C businesses and marketing because you just can't spend resources interacting with them. Then you have different sizes. It ends with whales that do like a million of business with you. That's totally different sales process, possibly a very small but very senior experienced team, where we see the sweet spot both for B2B startups and for the advice from our book is if you are in the range of deals with 10,000 annually to 100,000 annually. That's small enough that you can still likely work with hundreds of leads, but it's also those tickets are large enough. If you close one, two, three per month, you see momentum and you have enough traction to impress investors, which is very hard to do if you're hunting whales, because then one whale is very digital and there may be only very few of them to be hunted.
Right. I agree. That sort of brings me to the pricing and the negotiation part of your book, right? So I would sort of align them together. Pricing is definitely one of the key issues, and there's a lot of discussion in the digital space around this. Some very interesting companies as well. Do you think founders are basically pricing themselves out of the market in the sense that they're pricing too low?
Yes, that was actually one of the learnings of doing these interviews with those impressive founders. We got a very consistent signal that you have to be incredibly aggressive in your pricing. So there is one quote from a successful founder, now a successful VC, who basically said, when you are about to walk into a meeting and you feel very uncomfortable with the price, you should increase it by three and then walk into the meeting. We had also quotes, we never really lost a deal on price. We constantly increase. And the key point is any little bit of price increase you can achieve goes directly into profit. So many founders, especially those a little bit uncomfortable with sales, may go too low just for a little bit of extra comfort, for not pushing it too hard, for making it easier, but that's the wrong instinct. If in the end you have to serve five customers for the same revenues instead of two, your profitability will just be miserable. So that's a message I'd really like to send to founders around the world. Dare to be aggressive. Of course, there's a logical limit. So pricing ties back to what you have identified as the value you deliver for the customer. If you have quantified that, of course, that's a logical upper limit of what you can claim. But within that frame, shoot for the stars.
So what happens when you are, I mean, for example, I'll take an example of a SaaS company. And suppose you say that, okay, my cost is $10,000 per annum. and now the customer wants to negotiate, what do you do? How many different pricing do you offer? One of the pluses of a SaaS business is that you don't negotiate individually and it's a flat pricing and everybody who comes in takes the same price and so on. Yet you do open yourself up for negotiation with companies, even if you're selling SaaS. So how do you react to that?
That very much depends on which stage of the process you are. With your very first customers, you of course also care about getting this feedback loop of being a running company and getting feedback, and there may be a logo you want. Sometimes you can make a special deal for extra learning. You should just make very clear that this isn't your future pricing. So it may be a discount for the first year that then disappears after a year.
Right.
Something that you give as a benefit to that partner. And then over time, the trick is in designing your pricing structures such that you give customers a chance to self-select. So often there is a bronze, silver, and gold tier, and there is a lot of skill needed to set those right in order to make sure that those who only want or can afford a certain level get something that is valuable for them but also has some limitations that makes them consider or move into your world. And it's also a key point, and that's stressed by this last chapter on customer success. It's not decisive at which value you enter the company with the first contract. This is just the beginning of its journey. So you can enlarge it significantly over time. Actually, one of my favorite KPIs when I evaluate a company as an investor is called net revenue retention. That's a measure of how deep you grow into your existing customers.
Yeah.
So if at the beginning of a period you have 100 customers with 100 units of revenue, after a year you may have 85 left, but those 85 may produce 130 units of revenue. And that means you grow in revenue before any of your salespeople even was active.
Right.
So then you have this growth already driving your company, plus anything your sales team can deliver. And on anything your sales team delivers, you again start this virtuous cycle. So that's actually the movement and momentum that explains many unicorn cases.
Sure, absolutely. It's the opposite of churn, right? So it's exactly the opposite of churn. I mean, you're looking at the churn rate. Most are not, actually. Most are really trying to fill the top of the funnel, get people in, and a lot of the money that people raise gets spent on that.
Yeah, I like that image. I mean, many people know how painful a churn rate is. And just think about if you could flip the sign and have this force of nature on your side for your business. And that's what you do when you grow deeper into your existing customers and systematically increase the revenue you get out of them.
Absolutely. And there, I think the whole point of structuring and giving people the ability to choose and buy additional things. So basically, it's not like a flat, everything is available to everybody kind of thing. A basic thing is available and use add-ons to use a simple idea to get and garner more revenue. So it's not only additional seats inside a company, but additional functionalities, additional value.
Can be any kind of transaction. So two case studies we have in the book. One is a French startup or now a significant company called Algolia, who do search algorithms kind of for online search for companies for integration into their website. So they literally can sneak into a company on a 100 euro ticket on someone's credit card because an engineer wants to try it. But as they grow per search, they have this inbuilt growth, so they grow with their customers. And the second case study is Germany's most successful startup of the decade. So it's Celonis. They do process mining. So a company that extracts data your ERP system generates anyway, but really uses it to analyze processes to visualize them. And last time I looked, they were an 11 times unicorn. And we spoke with their COO, who's also a student of mine, Jonas Rieke. And he has like 500 people running this customer success function. And he explained that in the interview we have in the book in very detailed fashions. But they also dared to do a price change, which involved an element of price increase. So even in an existing company with customers, you can continuously work and optimize your pricing and align it closer with the value you generate. So key point is you need your value you generate in a deep understanding of it and the pricing to the quantification to design your pricing. And if you align your pricing with that insight, you make it also easier for your customers because you have the benefit and the costs aligned. So when you go into budgeting, or the perfect world would be your client goes to the controller and says, we spent 20 for this, but we save 100. Let me show you the numbers. And then it's easy to get funding out of the target company.
Absolutely. Do you think incentivizing sales team through monetary compensation is still a valid method to motivate, or should we relook at this whole incentivization system?
I think salespeople are so used to compensation kind of having a variable component that I probably wouldn't rock the boat on that. So kind of but in the book, we have a whole chapter on how to do that. So, but we also say it should be within reason. So we rather see the sweet spot at maybe 20 to 40% of compensation being subject to targets. We wouldn't go to the extremes. But I think those extremes are probably also not prevalent in Europe from where we started when we wrote the book. And then you can have a mix of team targets, of individual targets, depending on the role. If you have someone very early in the funnel who just sets up demos, you may incentivize him on how many demos he set up and what resulted from those demos. So we have some checklist of what we consider good basis for a bonus and a bad bonus basis for a bonus. And it partly, I think, these bonus systems also help to send a very clear message what you look for, what you value, and what you incentivize. So as head of BI and head of controlling of a large telco in a prior life, I kind of know how difficult it is to run these systems and to get them right. And general observation is if they are well designed, they can be extremely powerful, but there are many ways to mess it up.
Sure. Customer success, I mean, do you think it should be part of a singular organization like some people are trying to unite it under the CRO, or do you think it's a separate silo that one should develop in the organization?
That depends a lot probably on the individual organization. The two concepts are, in a perfect world, you'd want continuity so that the customer has as few people that he needs to get familiar with, that needs to be onboarded and learn this. At the same point, I see that the skill set to talking to a prospect or an opportunity and converting them, that's more of a hunter mindset. And then working with these customers, fixing problems and then building on that opportunity is more of a gatherer mindset. So probably two different organizations step differently with one clear point of handover that needs to be very carefully managed is kind of my default starting position if I were to design something.
But it does have some complexity if you are looking at it from the customer's point of view, especially because the handovers are never very smooth. Right?
Yeah, that's what I said, but then focus on the handover. So, as a customer, you want the guy who made all those promises to own up for it and to be responsible. So right. Key point is you need people of the same caliber, of the same intensity, and this handover needs to be perfect. I mean, if you do a sales funnel, you start with 200, you nail it down to one, and you do all that effort, and then you mess up the installation, and you are not available at 10 p.m. when the customer has an urgent problem. I mean, that ruins the whole point. So
right, absolutely.
I think I have a very high expectation for the standard you have to deliver in these phases.
Right,
but
absolutely.
That you perfectly deliver what you promised is the only justification that you do all this sales process.
Absolutely, absolutely. Martin, before I let you go, I have one question for you. A lot of this discussion is typically about finding and going after the 3% of the market. Apparently, it's not my figure. This is a figure which floats around. 3% of the market, which is ready to buy today. Yet the 97% of the market, which will buy tomorrow or day after or next month or next year, is neglected. And which is why so much of competition in whatever we are doing, unless we have a very unique product. That's a different question. Mm-hmm. But most of us are in commodity business. So most of us are selling things which other people also sell and so on. How do you suppose startups can start engaging, you know, upstream when people are sort of getting ready? Because that's what will really create a dependable pipeline, right? And most people do not know. Nobody talks about how do you engage with a customer who is likely to buy 1 year down the line. There is no discussion about that at all. And that I think is the biggest challenge that sales has.
I mean, that goes back to crossing the chasm and Geoffrey Moore in kind of the understanding. And indeed, probably your first customers are outliers in terms of the ability to engage with startups and being able as an organization to take that risk and act. And in many organizations, those naysayers, those veto powers will have the upper hand. But I basically see it as an evolution. So a lot of your sales process, you cold calling people, you begging for a demo, you making the best out of that demo and you selling, the rudimentary structure will be the same. It's just that the story changes. So it will be, I mean, in the beginning, you sell innovation and you promise someone he's the first to use this. And along the road, you kind of suddenly say, no longer this is innovation. This is the new market standard. It's time to catch up. And in the end, you tell them, hey, all others using this, you better catch up. So you also evolve from a risky startup into an established player if you get into the 10, 20, 50 million range. So you also have more to offer in terms of security and stability of execution. And you just have to evolve your message to the customer along those lines.
Great.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Martin, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation.
My pleasure.
And And I hope that the book helps startups to get their act together.
That's the idea.
Thank you so much. We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.